Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. Presented by Belco Credit Union. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp to learn more about how Belco can help you. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
Good evening, everyone. I'd like to welcome you this evening to the Tattered Cover Bookstore. My name is Derek, so if you have any questions throughout the event, you can certainly find me. I'll be someplace around. And so after that, just want to let you know that. The second thing I want to let you know is just want to let you know how much I appreciate everyone coming out tonight on this rainy evening and supporting local independent businesses. It really does make a difference. So thank you for that. Tonight we have a great treat from an author whose first short story collection, Tunneling to the Center of the Earth, really impressed critics and made all the journals, and it was really well received. Now, that early entree led to this wonderful novel that we're enjoying tonight in paperback. The Family Fang is maybe that one idea, as I was reading parts of it, thinking about what if you really are doing something they're making up. Their parents are really doing some of these things on purpose just to see what happens. And I think tonight's author really does a great job of exploring that. And a funny yet true, sweet yet really authentic way. So amazing work. So without any further ado, I'd like to bring up tonight's author and we could get the event started. Thank you.
Hey. Thanks for coming out. It really is something I've been looking forward to get to read it at Tattered Cover, which is just an incredible bookstore that I've actually been to a couple of times. I'm really grateful that you came. Mostly nobody comes. Last week in Pasadena, nobody came, and the woman told me that it was because of Dancing with the Stars was on, which was like the worst thing to say. It did not help me. It did not make me feel better. And then I know American Idol is tonight, so I really appreciate you coming out. I was just going to talk real quick about the book. If you don't know anything about it, it's about a husband and wife, Caleb and Camille, who are performance artists. They create these very public, very chaotic performances, spectacles. And what's made them kind of famous or infamous is that they use their young children, Annie and Buster, as props in their performances, which kind of ruins the children when they get older. It ruins them as children, and then we see how it's ruined them when they get older. And I started writing this book because I had signed a two-book deal with Echo, and so I gave them the short stories, and they liked that. And so I figured they'd like the next thing that I wrote, and it was this about 150 pages of this kind of Southern Gothic fairy tale about a half-human, half-bear baby, and they hated it. They hated it so much. They didn't like it, so they rejected it, and I had nothing left. That was my best idea. That was all I had. But my wife had just given birth to our first son, Griff, about 3 months before this. And so I had no ideas. And all that was going on in our lives was just the constant upkeep of keeping our son alive, which was harder than we thought it was going to be. He was kind of an awful first-year baby. He didn't eat or sleep, and he screamed all the time, and he just didn't seem to appreciate what we were giving him. And it was really difficult, and it was difficult trying to write. And every time we tried to do something for Griff, he would just scream. And I told my wife, I said, "This feels so much like abuse. I mean, this really seems like we are abusing him in some way." And she said, "No, you know, all parenting is abuse. That's just what you do. That's what you have to do." And so, so I started thinking about that, and I thought, I'll write about some parents. I'll write about worse parents than the two of us. And this is what I came up with. And this is actually a section that's not in the book. For the paperback, they asked me to write some new performances for some sort of promotional material that I never found out how it was used. But I wrote them, so I figured I should get something out of them. So this is a performance, and it's presented like a work of art, so it has a title and a date. It's called Lost and Found, 1988, artist Caleb and Camille Fang. Wandering the department store, Buster had no problem pretending to be lost. It was not an unusual thing for him to stand in a space and be totally unsure of how to proceed or how to make it back home. And yet, no matter how lost he pretended to be, he could not ignore the presence of his parents, both of them shadowing his movements, recording him, observing him, waiting for him to make the unknown thing known to everyone else. He had accumulated strange skills in service of his parents' art, and one of those skills was the ability to know when someone was following you. He had figured this out by following other people, 6 or 7 feet behind them, never once looking at them, and yet moving as if connected by a thin line of wire. He knew that his mother was a few feet to his left, holding shopping bags filled with her own clothes, conversing with a woman behind the perfume counter. His mother was rubbing the scent of juniper berries into her wrist, her fingers on her pulse as if unsure of if her heart would keep beating. His father, who was becoming a master of hiding surveillance equipment under his clothes, was more than 10 feet from Buster and was holding one of a pair of high heels as if trying to determine if it was possible to kill someone with it. His sister, well, she was hard to keep track of. She was somewhere, he could feel it, but he could not see her. But knowing that she was near him, perhaps hiding in a rack of clothes, gave him the strength to move into the next phase of the performance. Buster found a security guard who looked bored, who was observing her chipped fingernail polish, and having built up static electricity by shuffling across the carpeted floor, he shocked her with the slightest touch. Thanks to the jarring experience, combined with the sight of Buster, his eyes wide open and leaking tears, his breath hiccuping in and out of his body, the security guard immediately snapped to attention and leaned close to Buster, who could smell the same juniper-scented perfume on her. The scent, having only minutes before been connected to his mother, unsteadied him, but he resisted the urge to find his parents once again, their bodies obscured by the activity in the store. "Are you okay?" the woman asked. Buster shook his head. He took her hand and pulled her even closer to him. "I'm lost," he told her. "I've lost my mom and dad." Sometimes the woman pulled Buster through the store, and others, when she hesitated, wondering if they would ever find his parents, he pulled her along. And then, as if linked by telepathy, he could sense that his parents wanted him to make a discovery to end this phase of the performance. He looked at the crowd of people, all of them moving in different directions, all staring at different things. "There," he finally said, more shouted than spoken, and he pointed at who he had finally chosen, his parents. His parents, his new parents. He shouted, "Mom, Dad," and letting his face reconstruct itself into an expression of deep joy and relief, no real emotion behind the mechanics, he ran toward them, arms open for their embrace. "Oh, thank God," the security guard said, clapping her hands as if she had just witnessed the end of a play. The woman was so tall, at least 6 feet tall. She was tall enough that, if she had not played basketball in college, she had spent most of her adult life having to tell people this fact in the face of that inevitable question. She had short blonde hair and wide blue eyes, and her teeth, Buster noticed, were crooked but shockingly white. Her husband was nearly 6 inches shorter, thick glasses and a soft mustache, wearing a Kiss concert t-shirt. His new parents were, Buster was certain, good people. They had kind faces. Even after he called them his mother and father, knowing for certain that they were not, they still seemed open to the idea, as if Buster had suggested something they were amenable to discussing. Even as he finally reached them, entangling himself in their legs, they calmly assessed the situation and looked to the security guard for help. "I got lost," Buster said, "but now I found you guys." He hugged them again, and the woman leaned over him and touched his face as if she expected to recognize him. "What's this? What's going on?" the man said. The security guard was still smiling, the situation rectified, but now she replied, "I found him wandering in the lingerie section. He was so upset. Had you not noticed he was gone?" "No," the man said. "You should really keep an eye on your child," she continued. "There's no telling what could happen to him in a crowded place like this." "Yeah, but no," the man said, again dumbfounded. "Dad," Buster said, knowing he was shorting the circuits in their brains. He started to cry again. "I didn't know where you were." "No," the man said. "He means that he's not our kid," the woman finally said. "We don't have any kids. We're not even married." "Not yet," the man said. Hopefully, Buster thought. "Right, not yet," the woman repeated, nodding in agreement. "Well, you've got a kid right there," the security guard said, gesturing toward Buster, who was still holding on to their legs. "He's your kid." "Let's go home," Buster said. As soon as he said these words, he found that he meant them. Let's go home. He imagined the three of them driving to some new place, a bed and a room already reserved for him. And then he remembered Annie, and he pushed the dream from his mind and focused on the necessary work to make this performance successful. "I want to go home now. I'm scared. You guys scared me. You left me all alone." "Oh, God," the man said, pulling himself away from Buster. I need a little space here." The woman knelt, still so much taller than Buster, and she brushed his hair out of his face. "Honey," she said, "you're scared. You're confused. We're not your mommy and daddy." "Yes," Buster said. He hugged her, and he felt her return the embrace. "But we're not," she said. "Someday," she said, "but not now." It was confusing to Buster. He was unsure if she was referring to children in general or him specifically. "Let's just go," the man said, pulling the woman back to her feet. He carefully touched the top of Buster's head and said, "I hope you find your parents, kid, but we have to go." "Well, we can't just leave him," the woman replied, still holding Buster's hand. "No, you most certainly cannot," the security guard said. She seemed to believe that her authority in the mall could force these people to accept the responsibility of a child. "You don't get to leave until all this is sorted out." "Yeah, but we're going to go see a movie," the man said, his voice cracking, things falling apart around him. This, Buster knew, would make his real parents so happy. "Please don't leave me again," Buster said. "I was so scared, and now I just want to go home." He looked up at the woman, and he saw her body give up its former shape. He saw it so clearly. He saw her give herself over to him, the way her shoulders slumped, and she gripped his hand more tightly, and he knew that she would take him home with her. She would be his new mother. She had in this moment been completely reconfigured. She would not be his new mother. She was, and always had been, his mother. She smiled, and Buster was temporarily mesmerized by her crooked, shining teeth, and then Annie, as if conjured by magic, was suddenly by his side. "Come on, Thaddeus," she said, trying to pull him free from the woman's grip. "Mom and Dad are looking for you. They're about to leave." The woman did not let go of Buster, and Buster strangely tightened his grip on both the woman and Annie. Was this the moment? Could the three of them run out the doors of this store and never once look back? There was a second, less than a second, for this to happen. Buster tried to communicate through touch, to tell them what needed to happen. "I think maybe I should get the manager," the security guard said. She considered this for a moment and then said, "You know, maybe I better call the police." And that was it. The moment had passed, and Buster extricated his hand from the woman's, and he and Annie slipped away from the disaster they had made and pushed their way out of the store and into the parking lot. Just like that, before the three people left behind had time to consider it, they had disappeared. "Oh, they wanted you," Mr. Fang said to his son on the drive back home. "She would have taken you, I could tell." "And who wouldn't?" Mrs. Fang said, smiling at Buster with what Buster could only call love. "Who would not want you for their very own?" And that's all I got. Thanks. So now, so like when no one comes, you get to just go, you know, you get to leave, and it's, the awkwardness has already happened. But now there's this next awkward part, which is if there are any questions, I'm happy to answer them. And then there's like a pause. Yeah, yeah. All right, great. Thank you. You got rid of that awkwardness immediately. Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Was it there from the beginning, or was the idea of did the performances kind of come out of the process of building a family, or at what point did they kind of merge?
Oh, so how did the performances kind of come about? Yeah. So when I knew I had to write another book, I didn't really know where to start, and I was going through a bunch of failed stories, of which I have many. I kind of keep them just in case there's like a sentence or something I want. And I had this old story I had written about a brother and sister who have to play Romeo and Juliet in this high school play because the town is so small. And it was not a good story. But I really liked that brother and sister. I kept thinking about them a lot. And the thing I kept asking myself was what, not so much why they would agree to do it. I could figure that out. It was what kind of parents would let their son and daughter do that. And that's when I started to think, oh, they're artists, you know, they're these grand artists. And then I kept thinking more and more, well, they're performance artists. They would love this. And so from that's where I kind of got the idea. And then it was, for whatever reason, maybe because the baby had been a difficult baby, but like it was pretty easy to think up ideas of how to ruin a kid or how to psychologically abuse a child. They came really fast and furious. They were much easier to, it was just like another one, boom, instantly. All right, another one, here it is. So those came really fast. Those were much easier to write for some reason. I think it was easier to show how the kids got messed up than it was to show the after effects of that. So I always looked forward to the chance to write another performance piece. Yeah. Anything else? Yeah, Alex.
So this the novel that did not get picked up about the half bear.
Yes.
Half boy or half man thing.
Yeah.
What do you feel like you, I don't know, besides the fact that Echo did not take it, was there something about writing that taught you something that you then used for this movie?
Well, so that novel failed, and I can see why, because I'd gotten really hung up on Cormac McCarthy. I'd reread every single one of his books in chronological order, and I thought, I'm going to do this. It shouldn't be that hard. It's just Cormac McCarthy. I'm sure anybody that reads all of his books in chronological order can now do it. So I had this idea. I'm obsessed with feral children. I always have been. Partly because we were kind of feral, my sister and I, without language. And so I knew I wanted to write about that, but I was trying to write really gothic, really bloody. Everybody was dying. The bear baby was kind of a monstrous creature. It was just really depressing and hard to write, and I was finding out that it's actually really difficult to do what Cormac McCarthy does, that it's pretty hard. It's harder than I thought. And I was getting something that was me and not him, but it wasn't totally working. And what my publisher just kept saying, they were like, you know what, you do lightness really well. That's your thing. You are not good at this kind of overt meanness and evilness and darkness. And so I didn't like hearing that at first, cause I think I can do anything. But I can, I found out. And so what it showed me was that the thing that I am good at is starting off with lightness and then gradually dimming that until it turns dark. But I can't start out dark. And so I figured out kind of how my engine runs, and it's lightness into darkness. And if I start the other way around, because when it failed, also they said, this is just so disturbing. It is so dark. It's very hard to read. And I said, because I was so desperate because the advance money had already been spent. And I said, give me 2 weeks. I said, I can lighten it up and it will be funny and you'll love it and I can change it. And so like I sat in this room and the only scene that I wrote was that they dressed up the half bear, half baby in a seersucker suit. And I thought, that is gold. I was like, this is going to save this novel. And I showed it to my agent, not even the editor. And my agent said, you really have to give up. You can't, this is not going to work. And so I finally, that was the last straw, that desperation of putting a animal baby in a seersucker suit. I realized I needed to start out light. I couldn't put it in later. So yeah, I kind of figured out what I couldn't do, which is nice to know when you're trying to write a novel, having never successfully written one. It's good to know kind of what you can do just so that it's a little easier. Anything else? And I have one more story and then I'll let you go, but there's a line in this book where Buster, he goes to speak to a school, and he finds this little pocket recorder of his father's, and he plays it, and it says this line. It says, we are fugitive, what is it? We live on the edge, a shanty town filled with gold seekers. We are fugitives, and the law is skinny with hunger for us. And it's just a nonsensical line, but it's a line that I've actually had for 12 years, and I've been trying to get it into something. And it was actually in the Half Bear, Half Baby book. I had that line. And the way it came about was I got a job in college. I worked at the medical center at Vanderbilt University. I worked in the network computing, so I repaired computers. But the big job I had was this was in 96, and so they had the entire policy and procedures manual for the medical center, which was like this high of papers. And they said, we want you to put this on the internet. And I didn't know how to do that. And they gave me a scanner and it broke. So I was typing by hand. I taught myself HTML and then I was typing it by hand. And it was just, and no one ever came into my, it was a closet and that they had turned into an office. And I just typed for like 4 hours a day with my headphones and no one ever came by. And it was just so mind numbing that eventually I just started writing just ridiculous stuff into the policy and procedures manual. And so I just made up all these lines and it was all about like after Noah's flood and these people built a city with sharpened sticks. And it was, but it would be like one sentence per like section 8J. And then I put one sentence down in the middle. And then I kept doing that over and over. And I told my friend who I was living with at the time, I said, I'm doing this thing. It's pretty fun. And, it didn't even take him like 2 seconds. He just grabbed a piece of paper and he wrote, we are, the edge is a shanty town filled with gold seekers. We are the new fugitives and the law is skinny with hunger for us. And he just handed it to me. He's like, put that in there. So I did. I put it into this section called Getting Into Print. And so for years and years afterwards, when I would go to that website, you could read that line. They never found any of the lines. And then eventually they redid the entire policy and procedures manual where it actually looked like a real website, but it disappeared, which made me so sad. But it was something that I really loved was this idea that I was hiding a story inside of another more boring story. And so that's what I was trying to do then. It was Eric, my friend Eric's line, but I knew I was going to hide that line. He lives in LA now, and I haven't seen him in a pretty long time, but I just had this dream of him maybe reading the book and seeing that line and thinking like, you son of a bitch, you got that, you got it in there. So if you read the book, you can find that line and you can see that it's the line that took 12 years for me to finally write. But anyways, thanks for coming. I really appreciate it. All right. Take care.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fode, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Authors on Tour Live has been presented by Belco Credit Union. Belco has been serving members' financial needs since 1936. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp to learn more about how Belco can help you. Stay pod-tuned in the coming weeks for many more authors as we podcast Authors on Tour.